Joe, how are you doing?
I'm doing just fine, Tim. How are you?
Very well. You're still enjoying that's the Southern Hemisphere, right?
It is in the Southern Hemisphere, and I'm still here. And a bizarre circumstance. My home is basically under a kind of martial law condition because of the cleanup work from the mudslides of Montecito. And where it is in the midst of it, though the home has not been damaged, all of the roads around it are under repair and none of the services work. And the community is sort of in its present form, kind of a physical metaphor of our topic. We want to talk about a real political science, you know. So you have the facade in Montecito of all these rich homes, but then nothing works underneath it. It's completely corrupted, and that is how, you know, I see the modern university. What do you think about the modern university, Tim? Like how should people understand it?
Well, as far as the what's taught to the students there, or how the system works, and perhaps a political science course that they might take, or a civics course they might take, is they're told that in regards to the United States, at least, it's the oldest constitution still in effect, never been canceled or never been violated, I suppose. But we learn that we've had some 239 years of constitutional government. There's the federal government that consists of three branches: the executive, the legislature, and the judicial. And they all check each other, which is good because they all keep each other honest. That keeps the Constitution safe from political ambition. We elect our representatives in the House of Representatives in a popular way. Popular election, and then we elect two senators for every state, and of course we get together and we pick our president via the electoral college system that roughly follows the popular will. And these are all public servants; these are statesmen that represent the will of the people. Same thing at the state level, I suppose. With you, at most states have bicameral legislatures with a governor and a state supreme court, and basically these are sort of roughly similar to how the federal government functions. And these governments, too, represent the popular will of the people. We have competing political parties to check ambition, to keep each other honest. So, heck, if the Democrats go too far, we can throw the bums out and elect the Republicans. And Republicans go too far, we can throw those bums out and elect the Democrats. And everyone is at least happy every 4 to 8 years. The system works. It revitalizes faith in the system. And we can go on. This political science, we learn about sort of political philosophies and ideologies. Communism, fascism, socialism, Marxism, capitalism. Of course, we read about things like the radical critique and the realist critique in political science, and how these ideologies will turn people's worldviews and shape political agendas and these things. And you learn all about these things in college and textbooks, and this is how the world works. And government is there to represent the will of the people, at least in the democratic West, where laws are passed after a solemn legislative process. Laws are passed by the people who are elected by the people, so that it's representative. So really have nothing to worry about, because the law is ultimately government is us. We're the government in the United States. Government by the people, for the people, as Abraham Lincoln said back in 1863. So that's how the system works. The courts protect our rights. The judicial system, the criminal justice system, protects us from the barbarians, the criminals out there, protects property. The police are there to protect us. And of course, if these government agencies misbehave, we always have the Fourth Estate, which we've talked about. And they're there to keep government officials honest, keep corporations honest, because the Fourth Estate is separate, independent, full of investigative reporters, aggressive editors like Ben Bradley, and little undercover corruption. And so, have to sit back and buy the newspaper every morning, read the newspaper with our coffee every morning, or watch TV, watch the Today Show, watch Matt Lauer. Tell us how the world works, and that's all we really have to do as citizens, because all these millionaires, all these celebrity journalists and investigative reporters, these celebrity talkers on CNN, NBC, ABC, whatever, will kind of distill the world for us and give us a way that we can understand, simplify things for us so we can go about, take care of our families, do our job, pay our taxes, and be good subjects, be good citizens. So that's how the world works. Any problems with that?
Right. Well, yeah, I actually disagree. I mean, this is without a doubt the very best synopsis, short, concise of America, right? Our political system that I've ever heard. You would get a passing grade in any civics course that I'm aware of in any university just by, the preamble to our show. It's just astonishing. However, the image that America is just this one big, happy, democratic family is incorrect. Basically, as I see it, the Constitution is simply part of the propaganda. The fact is the controlling group, the secret society, we'll talk about the nature of this organization as we go through this, but they're able to maintain power not in spite of the Constitution and people's understanding of what it means, but because of it. In other words, since they can control both sides of the political spectrum and through the control of the elected representatives, they can then control the judiciary. And through their control of the financial system, they can control the media. Basically, American citizens watch a kind of cartoon that is an illusion of reality. And this is what is given to us as our media. You talked about the Fourth Estate and how the Fourth Estate is there to protect us. Well, the Fourth Estate works with the three branches, the financial system, and the intelligence agencies, and they come up with this stuff which is given to us as news, but in fact, everything is just being basically constructed as propaganda. And so what I was suggesting is that we would have today the presentation of a different kind of university that would study political science, or of a different kind of university course. I'm not sure if it's many courses or just one, how it would be structured. But Tim, I'm not talking in a theoretical sense here. I'm not talking about this is what, would be possible to do. I'm talking about stuff that people could actually do. And so if we were to give the matriculating freshman a real political science course, something that would be useful, really useful to this individual, I think the first course, the Poli-Sci 101, would be civics in an enslaved world. This would be the very first, the beginning. In other words, it would have a description of the real nature of how the political system is manipulated by the oligarchs for their benefit. And so, it'd be very broad stroke. You would talk about the way that the two-party system can easily be subverted. You would talk about the nature of the financial system, about who owns it. So it'd be a very broad brushed stroked kind of course, But then you'd have the specificities, you know, you'd have, and I would think that after that overview, you would probably start out, if I was going to, you know, try to trace it out, I think you would start out with propaganda, and you would talk about how propaganda works so that the student could come to understand how he or she has been enslaved. And how would you talk about propaganda? Well, you know, you could give the idea of a lifetime actor, and you could show examples of this. You know, you could take Noam Chomsky, you could take Tim Leary. There's a lot of people that would be very easy to take as examples of how trust in a particular personality is created for the purpose that that personality then can take the population to a place that's easier to control, you know. So this would be like the first thing is propaganda. You know, it's like, well, how does propaganda work? And then the next course would be it would either be 911 101. You know, just to be like, what is 911? How are the demonstrable parts of it so that people can see that this was a false flag by the government. So those would be sort of like the platform, the freshman type courses that I would suggest. But the other one that I wanted to mention is something that could actually happen inside universities. Now, just to digress for one second, I'm not talking about that the only way these courses can be established is through a university. Tim, I'm saying that everyone can start right now. We can just use the internet, get internet groups to start producing ideas and courses along these lines and see if people will start to participate, start to join in, try to develop the curriculum. If you're in a university, here's what I would suggest. Have the university itself as the subject. In other words, a course like the university as a component of the slave system. And then, you know, like you know, and different examples could be given. One would relate back to the idea I was just talking about, where you could take 911 and you would say, okay, you go to the dean of the university and say, why isn't this being discussed? And get an explanation. And the point is to try to develop and try to have the students develop the schematic of the university, of where is the pressure coming from? Because like we talked about last week, because there is no one asking in the American university system things like, why did Building 7 collapse symmetrically? Why did it collapse at free fall speed?
Not even in the engineering schools.
Yeah, exactly. So because that's blank, we know that there is some control, some off the radar control that's coming in. So how does that work? And so that's why I would hope that students would go to, you know, the dean or whoever they can have access to, and then say, okay, well, have you been given instructions about this? And then try to flesh it out. Try to actually work out how it is that in engineering schools, where people would know about, you know, how controlled demolitions occur and what are the phenomena that are associated with them, why there is this not a major topic? What is coming down from the top? Who is doing it? And see, this would be a great way to develop a student energy, student, perhaps even the capacity for demonstrations, is to try to build that out, is to try to say, okay, here we are in a real civics course. We're really going to try to understand the political pressure and system inside our university. Why are certain ideas forbidden? Who forbids them? And then, of course, if you started to find that you had more and more people participate, you could branch out and say, okay, let's look at political correctness. Let's look at the Frankfurt School and how this became powerful in our university. Then the question is, well, who in the university basically represents it? How did they come to be? I think some of these people are just victims themselves. You know, they are like you have now, like many people who are, you know, transgender are being, you know, called to be professors so they can give courses in this. So you might have people that are themselves victims of the whole process, but there has to be people in decision-making positions that are steering the culture into the, you know, kind of pansexual world, the you know, the alphabet soup sexes kind of world. So who are they? And you see, when the students build out this, they can be giving, you know, using the printing press, you know, and everyone has access to a printer these days. And then you could start to say, okay, well, here's how we think it works. You know, Professor X is gets money from the government. He is a member of this secret society when he was in the university, so clearly he's was selected. Then he, these are his two primary henchmen, you know, Miss X, and, you know, and then, and you could start to develop an understanding of this political structure. So the student would be asked to basically build out the political system as an exercise, as an exercise in civics, so that the enslaved world would become clear. So those are my, you know, first courses that I would like to see in the, you know, in this new poli-sci structure.
Yeah, it's kind of a bit an overlook or like a broad approach to this. Of how the structure works, how the system works, how it really works. My thoughts is if you just had a dedicated course to, say, how political assassinations have historically been used as a successful tool to get rid of recalcitrant, troublesome political leaders. People aren't going along with the game plan. And explaining, you know, you can get into the, whether it's Martin Luther King assassination, Robert F. Kennedy, John F. Kennedy, even going even further back, real examination, how, you know, this has always been a political assassinations have historically been conspiracies going back to the days of Julius Caesar. And somehow we're supposed to think somehow in the United States things are different. Also, just and there have been studies of the study out of Switzerland, that foundation in Switzerland, talking about how the interlocking corporations, how just a handful of people actually control about 60% of the world's wealth, and how that sort of that concentrated interlocking corporate world is going to exert incredible political influence and power internationally, and it does. And you could just point out, even in the United States, the role, or at least the influence of corporate power, corporate concentration, family wealth, you know, how it's been sort of laundered now through things like think tanks and foundations, and how these things endow universities, museums, think tanks, various foundations that are supposedly apolitical, various non-government organizations, NGOs, and these things, charitable organizations, charities is one of the primary methods that these ruling families influence society and hide their wealth, hide their vast wealth from taxation. But basically, you want to present a picture here that would, you know, make it clear to people, despite all the propaganda, despite what they're taught in Civics 101. And how, you know, we elect our leaders, and the leaders swear an oath to the Constitution, and they're held accountable by the free press, by the American people, and the press itself informs the American people enough that they can select candidates that run in primaries, and then they go out and vote. And the primaries select the you know, their respective candidates for the political office, and roughly speaking, the will of the people, you know, is heard. But really, the republic and our representative democracy has long since yielded to the oligarchic power, and or to the extent that our government exists, at least to the extent that what we see now, our government only has a superficial resemblance to a functioning republic or democratic republic. And by just pointing out this, the history of, you know, these ruling families and how they control the banks, your point about the banking system is important, how the financial system sort of enables the control of the entire system, whether it's the political process or the media, which is supposed to inform us about what's going on in the world. One of the things I was thinking about, there's two movies, two very different movies. which I think are a good, at least will is a good description of what we're talking about tonight. One is, of course, is a comedy by with Rodney Dangerfield, Rodney Dangerfield, Back to School, is made in 1986. And I don't know if you've seen the movie.
I have.
But there's a very funny scene in it where he's attending business class with his son, and there's a very arrogant professor there with a British accent, and he's Rodney is in class there, and the professor is for the purposes of instruction in his class, he's setting up a fictional factory, and he says he's going through the says, well, of course, and the professor there is talking, says, and the bottom line is when we get up our factory, we have to think about not just the material cost, the construction cost, architectural fees, land surveys, and stuff like that. Then Rodney Dangerfield interjects, says, oh, you left out a whole bunch of stuff. And he says, well, would you enlighten the class, the professor says. And, you know, first of all, you get Rodney Dangerfield goes, you're going to have to grease the palms of the local politicians because for all of a sudden, you know, they have these zoning problems that pop up. So you're going to have to pay off the politicians. Then you're going to have to play kickbacks to the carpenters. Then you're going to have to, if you're going to use cement for this factory, you're going to have to pay off the Teamsters. And then he says, then there's a long-term cost. And he says, that's the things like sanitation or waste management. And he says, I don't know if you know who runs that industry, but they're not the Boy Scouts. And then the guy, the professor goes, listen, I teach legitimate business here. Bribery, kickbacks, mafia payoffs aren't in the realm of legitimate business. And Roger Dangerfield kind of laughs, and the professor goes, well, now we have to think about where we're going to build this this factory. And Rodney Dangerfield goes, oh, how about Fantasyland?
Yeah.
You know, so there's the academic world. There's the theoretical world. Then there's the real world. Another movie I was thinking about is called A Very Violent Year, or A Very Dangerous Year, I think. A most violent year. And it was a kind of independent movie made a couple of years ago. And that's just about it's a guy who runs an oil and heating home heating company in New York in the early 80s. And he supplies a superior product, superior service, and he's beating out the competition. And lo and behold, he runs into trouble with the incumbent companies that have connections to the Teamsters. And they start to, shut him down, extort him, shoot his drivers. And all of a sudden, he's being investigated by the local district attorney for embezzlement and tax fraud. And he has to go through all this stuff while trying to grow the company, stay in business. He has to obtain loans under the table and these things. It turns out he prevails at the end. And his wife is the accountant, played by Chastain is her name, the red-haired actress. She was in Zero Dark Thirty, I think. And her character is she's the daughter of a mafiosa. And she learned accounting tricks from her father. And what happens is, at the end of the day, he's able to have enough capital to survive this. And he wins. He makes the deals, and he wins. Stays in business. And he thinks it's all his achievement that has done this, because he's so good. And his wife kind of opens his eyes and says, basically, his wife was able to embezzle funds, hide money from the tax man, and now they have the money to survive. And she says to him, do you think you only are successful because you're so smart? He says, I know how to play the other half of the game. And it turns out the DA, who's trying to prosecute him, is just shaking him down for a campaign contribution. And he bet.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the world.
Yeah, well, I know. Gosh, I would like to talk about some of my personal experiences with, like, certain government entities in California, but mm-hmm. I may live there again one day, and I'm not sure. I would underline that perspective 100%. What is real as opposed to, the illusion is just critical for the citizen to like come to his or her senses immediately. Otherwise, they're really defenseless, and they'll never really be able to make it. Unfortunately, in our world, I think it's just it's at that point now where, corruption is in the United States is basically at every corner. Try to address the solution as like a physics class thing. I have no idea, because you'd have to start to get into, how can you recreate moral order?
Yeah.
To do that, you'd have to have control of the education system and everything else. But ultimately, you'd have to control the finances, because that would be one thing I would really like to see taught in poli-sci classes, is just the course would be why we, like the dollar, why do we believe it has value?
Mm-hmm.
And just go into the idea of the dollar as propaganda, the dollar as a system of control, the dollar as a system of illusion. I mean, it's comes out of nothing. The people who create it are able to always make themselves wealthier and the public poor every time credit is created. Mm-hmm. Every time credit is created, Tim, they become wealthier, we become poorer, and the basic substance of our wealth, the dollar, becomes less valuable.
Mm-hmm.
It happens slowly, so people can't see it, but it surely is the case. And that this belief in the dollar is a terrible problem in terms of effective citizenry. And this is what I would, like to see civics courses more engaged with. The ones that I would hope would be established by the citizens themselves would really focus on this. It's not so much this theoretical stuff, like it's good to know, but, what can we do really? If we're going to have this kind of fiat currency, then we can't have private corporations owning the power of credit creation. So a civics course would talk about, what it is, what fiat currency is, get the people to be aware of the fact that it does come from nothing, and then that since it is created basically out of thin air, then the profits from it, if you can maintain that kind of a system, should all go back to the people. At this point, it's going to be really hard to try to get back to any kind of currency that's based on anything. The current generation, the young people, they have a chance to replace a lot of these government corrupt systems. I mean, I think that the Republicans and the Democrats are so hopelessly corrupted and so owned that the younger generation would be wise to be encouraged simply to replace them, to try to develop their own political system using the internet and using social media, which of course are often controlled themselves, but at least you'd have a chance to set up a competing entity. And, that's why like cryptocurrencies are very interesting in terms of civics, because, mm-hmm. They're not owned by the oligarchs. At least we don't know if they are. But to me, not knowing exactly how stuff, where it comes from, this usually is just a red flag, and it normally means that in back of it all, you're going to find one big fat oligarchic cesspool. So, but to have a course that would cover, or even separate courses that would cover the real nature of, of survival in a corrupt financial system, and then try to also encourage thinking about how to move forward, how to have some ideas that we can do better, can we start to hopefully to make more and more people aware that the fiat system is owned by the oligarchs for their benefit, and then organize resistance and change.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And I think a good place to focus would be also another is a class that would highlight or focus on the relationship between government agencies, the intelligence agencies, and so-called organized crime. There's a rich history to this, and it would expose the true nature of the system, how closely related government, the spy agencies are to organized crime. You have a couple of historical examples that are well documented now. One of them is during the Second World War. You had the Luciano Project, where Lucky Luciano was freed from prison by Thomas Dewey, the governor of New York, to help the Navy deal with some of their problems with suspected Italian, which probably wasn't really Italian. It's probably more mafia, actually. There that ship, the Normandy, was burned because the Navy had taken over the docks, and I think it's suspected that the mafia itself burned the ship as a message to the U.S. Navy that they better respect their territory. And it's kind of funny to show how powerful the mafia was at that time. The Navy had to negotiate with them. They did when they got in touch with Meyer Lansky, and Meyer Lansky negotiated a deal where Thomas Dewey would release Lucky Luciano from prison. He was doing 30 years in prison at the time. And he was eventually released and then deported to Italy, where he helped with the Allied invasion of Sicily, and he was rewarded, more or less with control of the heroin trade coming east from Turkey into Europe, and then, I guess this was a so-called French Connection or something. But that deal was struck. So that highlights the role how the OSS, the military would work with organized crime, and will support or even get involved with narcotics trafficking and other criminal activity to support their geopolitical objectives. And pretty soon, the two are so intermingled that you really can't distinguish the two anymore. We see that later in Vietnam and even in Central America, and even now in Afghanistan and the heroin trade coming out of Afghanistan. So that's a good example. Another example, more recently, one thing, you also had Operation Mongoose, and the CIA, Alan Dulles, worked with Johnny Roselli and Santo Trafficante and Carlos Marcello and these guys to try to take Castro out, and some people think it was reverse engineered, and they had John F. Kennedy murdered, these things. That's one of the more popular theories out there regarding the JFK assassination. But this how intimate the CIA was with these well-known mafiosos, organized crime figures. Another more recent, I think, is the role that the MENA airport and the cocaine trafficking coming out of Central America in support of the Contra War in the 1980s. This involved George Bush, the NSA, Oliver North, and the then Governor Bill Clinton. And what was happening there is the CIA asset and international drug trafficker Barry Seal had hundreds of millions laundered through in Arkansas. And this was eventually laundered through this outfit called the Arkansas Development Finance Authority. There was created by the Arkansas legislature at the urging of Bill Clinton. And this gave the governor there pretty much the ability to issue credit unlimited. And he more or less enriched his friends. It was initially started to attract capital and business to Arkansas. One of the primary beneficiaries of this, now it's important to point, is cocaine money was being laundered through the Arkansas Development Finance Corporation through the bonds that were being issued. So this cash was being laundered through the Arkansas Development Finance Corporation, and one of the major companies that benefited from that, one was Tyson's Food, and the other was Walmart. And so,
right,
understanding that these corporate monstrosities that we live with now, Walmart every corner, that the role that narcotics trafficking plays in helping these corporations grow, become so dominant, and destroying small to mid-sized local companies and these things, this helps sort of create this. Basically, what I'm saying is the role of narcotics trafficking in distorting the economy, enriching a few select corporations, whether it's capitalizing Wall Street, capitalizing banks, capitalizing these corporations, or some of these corporations like Walmart, because they're being used, I guess what it looks like perhaps they're being used as a money laundering operation for drugs. They benefit and they grow so large and they destroy local mid-sized businesses, and that helps spread globalism. At the same time, the Walmart was being set up for growth in the 70s and 80s. That's also the time when, of course, you had the trilateralist agenda and the setting up of China as the world's manufacturing center for so much, which now lines the shelves of Walmart. So you're getting a broader economic plan there. Of course, we've talked about in the past the deals with the petrodollar and how Henry Kissinger, you know, fomented the Yom Kippur War, created the petrodollar, and these things so they could manipulate currencies and cause oil prices to go up, create an energy crisis, which would traumatize the country and fundamentally change its economy. It would ultimately lead to this macroeconomic decisions that were made, the petrodollar creating more or less enthroning it as the world's reserve currency, would ultimately lead to the deindustrialization of the United States, because basically it made the U.S. dollar artificially strong, which made imports artificially cheap and our exports artificially expensive. So you have the process of this deindustrialization that's occurring, which is a larger agenda that we see with the ruling elite and the trilateralist and these things. And this is never taught in political science. These sort of this behind the deals, behind the scenes, gray eminence deals that are being made by, you know, schemers like Henry Kissinger and Zbigniew Brzezinski, working with their bosses, which aren't Richard Nixon, they're really, or Jimmy Carter, it's really David Rockefeller and the Rothschild family that they're really working for. So, and getting if students of political science get an understanding of the importance of wealthy banking families and these oligarchic families and controlling these things, much less attention would be paid on various elections and who won what election, who lost that election, and who stole what election, who's stealing this election, because that's really ultimately, that's not really that important. So,
right. And okay, so that last point is key, because one of the courses should be like the false dialectic, how, you know, they create these two sides in a struggle and people get to choose one or the other, but mm-hmm. both are controlled by... And so people should know how that works as an element of propaganda. And I wanted to back up, because you broached a subject that is sort of dear to my heart, and I wanted just to expand on a second. You know, you talked about Walmart. If you look at the original funding of Walmart, you know, which springs out of nowhere, right, this mm-hmm. meteoric rise, you can see it's getting all of this money through this Arkansas Development Fund. And, you know, you have to know a little bit about Arkansas. I mean, Tim, at that point, the state didn't have enough money to, you know, buy a net to catch alligators with, you know. I mean, like, where are all mm-hmm. of these hundreds of million dollars of money coming from, you know? It's like you say, well, Clinton got the ability when he was, when he was governor to create credit. You know, he tried a mini little Federal Reserve. But it was really only used for a few corporation. So Walmart is a very artificially created corporation. Its funding seems to be coming mainly through the government. Look at the high-tech corporations today, Amazon. Look how long it existed without making any money. Look at Bill Gates' family background mm-hmm. into things like Planned Parenthood. Look at the absurd and artificial relationship Gates was given with IBM to basically have the operating system for the PC, to basically just take this whole business opportunity from IBM to burst out. You know, you have these corporations. Look at Tesla now. Look at the artificial financing that's coming into a company that's never made any money, like Amazon. Mm-hmm. Bezos is supposedly the wealthiest guy in the world. Well, gee, he's never made a dollar. I mean, the corporation loses money every year. These are artificial constructions. They are being created for the purpose of control. Microsoft, Tesla, Walmart. I mean, the huge corporate winners need to be exposed in the civics class as being artificial constructions so that people can see how they are basically organized politically. They're there for control, for food control, for medical control, for physical movement control, so that cars will have GPS systems that'll be self-driving cars be controlled. You know, so you have to see how the oligarch looks at his ant colony downstream. All of these, you know, Amazon, how it's going to replace, the acquisition of little widgets and stuff. You know, you get it through Amazon. You don't go to the local store. All of these things end up with fewer and fewer people having more and more control. You know, they're all, from the perspective of the civics class, they're all examples of enslavement. That's really what they are. I mean, I'll just reference something. I'm sure it's online. Can't really recall where I saw it, but I believe it was on the internet. There's a famous press conference where Walmart is getting off of the ground, right? They're announcing how they're going to be a successful company, and they've got this press conference. And in attendance were George Bush Sr. and Jr. They're on the stage with the Walmarts. Well, gee, I mean, how does a little department store in the middle of
retail?
Retail,
which is, I mean, the profit margins are very thin on retail, and some of this is able to grow. And are they getting cheap capital?
That's the key. I was just going to say that these companies, if you look at them, what they're all going to have in common is they have access to cheap capital, because this is part of the fiat way of control. Tim, if I have access to unlimited cheap capital, well, gee whiz, that I don't have to pay back or can pay back at whenever I feel like it, I can just take over the whole planet, right?
Yeah, it's like Austin Fitz says, if you have two shipping companies and one is shipping produce from South America, one is shipping a white substance called sugar and bananas, and they're competing against a shipping company that's shipping in bananas and another white substance called cocaine, and that shipping company has protection from the CIA and higher ups. Which company is going to win out?
Exactly.
Which company is going to win out? And I just heard an interesting story regarding Bain Capital. Of course, Bain Capital is the Mormon outfit.
Mitt Romney.
Mitt Romney, and the source of Bain Capital, because they funded things like Staples. Of course, things like Staples have destroyed the local stationery store, which office supply store, which kind of used to be like hardware, used to be like kind of a local concern. You know, there were local stores and maybe a local chain, a local family that was successful. These same with the grocery stores too. They were localized, regional at least, and that's becoming increasingly central, concentrated and centralized. Romney went to work for what's called the Gay family. The Gay family were this Mormon family that supposedly were behind the kidnapping of Howard Hughes and the looting of his medical foundation, like $1 billion or something, and that became the seed capital for Bain Capital. And I've heard reports that Bain Capital is also involved in things like laundering drug money, which that is, again, if you know how that works, it isn't an outrageous accusation, because all those billions, hundreds of billions of dollars that are made through the illegal narcotics trafficking has to go somewhere, and it's not going to go under a mattress. It's going to go into a bank. It's going to be laundered, you know, through Goldman Sachs and these things, or outfits like Bain, which will get hold of that capital, and they will grow with it. And as they get bigger, they become the favorite outfits. They're the ones that get, you know, the 0.001% interest at the discount window. Why we get 18% on the credit cards?
Yeah, I'll just say it's the reverse. It's they become big because they are the favorite ones.
Yeah,
they're select.
Well, yeah,
and
yeah,
so
yeah.
This is an illusion. The idea of like market forces and Bain Capital. I mean, Romney is just such an absolute lifetime actor. It makes me sick to my stomach. I remember him during the presidential campaign. He was talking about, well, you know, creative destructions. I mean, my companies, we create a lot of jobs, but we also cost a lot of jobs. But in the end, that's just this.
Yeah,
this
it's the market,
process.
Yeah.
You know, and I would just point out one, his father was a director at Goldman Sachs before he was, you know, a senator. So you've already got wired into this banking family. Now, they're a Mormon, but what the hell is that? You know, I mean, it's this at that level, it's just secret society material. We don't know who Romney is, what, you know, he represents. I was reading that one of his roommates early on was Netanyahu. Well, is that like a normal roommate to have, you know, for a Mormon? Now, there's something, you know, that needs to be investigated there. But then in civics class, you'd have to look at the claim of, creative destruction. Capitalism is like some jobs are being lost, but then others are being created. Well, how about the idea that slaves are being created? When Bain Capital creates Staples, you get rid of all of the middle class jobs, the mom and pop, both manufacturing and the mom and pop sales, right? Mm-hmm. What do you replace it with? What are these jobs that Romney's talking about? these are all minimum wage jobs, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's a 100% shoot into slavery, basically, because you're taking away the ability of smaller people, or, you know, middle class people, to basically create some financial stability and security for themselves, from which they might be a political platform of, you know, organizing and maybe resisting this enslavement. Instead, you get the minimum wage person. Now, I mean, think about the two classes, right? The political class of people that Staples creates, right? Where the manufacturing jobs are in China, the retail is now all minimum wage, you know, high school dropouts. Haven't the oligarchs won this round? You see, mm-hmm. this is how civics classes should approach this kind of thing. This is why, like, Walmart and Amazon and Tesla and all of the winners, you know, Tim, it's just a completely fake world, buddy. And the winners out there are just the picked, you know, proponents of the oligarchic slave system. They're part of the problem. The people like Bezos and Gates are part of the problem. They're part of the system of enslavement.
Yeah,
and so they're not.
And Jeff Bezos.
Yeah.
A couple weeks ago, we talked about the Washington Post and the movie. Jeff Bezos buys the Washington Post.
Right.
And then he has a $100 million contract with the CIA or something.
Yeah. And so then, well, I mean, think about it. So the citizen is sitting there and going, well, I guess Bezos is not really just the, you know, kind of hand-picked puppet of the oligarchs, because I don't read anything about it in the Washington Post. Well, oh my. I mean, Bezos owns the Washington Post. So the whole thing is just a complete joke, and now it's time for the citizen to act, and that's what the class should produce.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the class that we're talking about, real civics class, would be basically, you know, the process by which the Revolutionary War is finally started.
And, when you look at Walmart and they say low prices every day, well, it's also low wages all the time, you know, so.
Right. And the philosophy is, well, we lose a little bit on every transaction, but make it up in volume, you know. The whole idea is preposterous. I really don't believe, I couldn't prove this, Tim, but this is my honest belief. If you look at the oligarchic slave setup corporations, if you look at, like, well, maybe Microsoft be an exception, but all the other ones like Tesla, Amazon, Walmart, what you would find, the ones that have come forward in the last like 20 years, what you find is they never made money. They never mm-hmm. had to. They always had access to, as you say, the discount window. They always had access to bizarre and absurd money that they could use to basically stay in business and to become huge in spite of the fact they didn't have anything they could sell
mm-hmm.
or profitably. They didn't have to. So what when you see huge corporations developing that have no real way of making money, particularly at the beginning, they're losing money, what you're looking at is part of the project. This is what the civic class should be studying.
And then they get local tax breaks and exemption from zoning.
Yeah, everything. No. Yeah, Walmart. It's like they little towns have to like beg Walmart to come in, you know, to get rid of all their real the businesses that could create a middle class, and you end up with Walmart. You know, it just dominates everything. And then, you know, like with Walmart, the minimum wage that they pay is below the criteria of the poverty line.
Yeah, they actually have training programs for people to go on food stamps.
Of course. I mean, this is how absurd it is that it's part of the welfare state. I was thinking when I read that, I go, you know what they should probably do is also just make it part of the penal system. You know, have these people like get cheap places to live in jail half of the time, you mm-hmm. know, because they really are just basically slaves. So why wouldn't you not throw in the penal system as well as the welfare state and then the minimum wage job? It's all just it's just there to create, a class of slaves. And see, this goes back to the original concept of civics in an enslaved world. And to my mind, every honest civics course in an enslaved world produces one thing. There's one you know, understanding and action that has to occur for a passing grade, and that's rebellion. This is what civics should be teaching now, rebellion.
Instead, it teaches, I guess, passivity and acceptance.
Yeah.
Everything seems to work.
Well, but they believe that, like, well, Walmart just made it because the Sam Walton was a smart guy. He had this idea that he would buy stuff cheap and then sell it cheap. I mean, what a genius. Or how about Amazon, you know, that you could buy books on the internet. Wow. He's a genius. I mean, it's incredible. Look at, like, Elon Musk, another just complete pseudo character. You know, he's like, you can pay for your stuff online, PayPal. He's a genius. It's incredible. He makes hundreds of billions of dollars, and now he's going into outer space. This is all ridiculous. These people are just puppets. They're just lifetime actors that are just put in positions to fool people into thinking that there really is a market. You know, but that's not how the system works. They're not there because they've you know, actually been in hand-to-hand combat with other competitors who were equally, you know, gifted. They're there because they were made by the oligarchs into these structures. And then what you're going to see is all of these corporations will be coming together soon. Microsoft, Tesla, Walmart, they're all going to be just part of the world we look at that controls us, right? It controls the software of the internet that comes into our house. It controls the nature of the food, you know, that we eat and the clothes that we wear. You know, and here comes the Amazon drone dropping off the latest drug shipment, you know, so that we don't feel anxiety. I mean, this is why these things have been created.
But this is the Internet of Things, right?
Yeah. And, so anyway, this is you can see how what a good idea it is to have a real civics course, because we might be able to actually teach some real stuff.
There was you mentioned some of these corporations. This reminds me of an article that I read a while back by Ron Unz. It's called "Are American Pravda, the Major Media Overlooked Communist Spies and Madoff's Fraud? What Are They Missing Today?" But in the article, he gets into some of these corporations, and he writes, "Aside from the evidence of our own senses, almost everything we know about the past or the news of today comes from bits of ink on paper or colored pixels on a screen. Unfortunately, over the last decade or two, the growth of the internet has vastly widened the range of information available to us in the latter category. Even if the overwhelming majority of the unorthodox claims provided by such non-traditional web-based sources is incorrect, at least there now exists the possibility of extracting vital nuggets of truth from the vast amounts of falsehood. Certainly, the events of the past dozen years have forced me to completely recalibrate my own reality detection apparatus. Thoughtful individuals of all backgrounds have undergone a similar crisis of confidence during the same period. Just a few months after 9/11, New York Times columnist Paul Krugman argued that the sudden financial collapse of the Enron Corporation represented a greater shock to the American system than the terrorist attacks themselves. And although he was widely denounced for making such an unpatriotic claim, I believe his case was strong. Although the name Enron has largely vanished from our memory, for years it had ranked as one of America's most successful and admired companies, glowingly profiled on the covers of our leading business magazines, drawing luminaries such as Krugman himself to its advisory board. Enron Chairman Kenneth Lay had been a top contender for the Treasury Secretary in the George W. Bush administration. Then, in the blink of an eye, the entire company was revealed to be an accounting fraud from top to bottom, collapsing into a $63 billion bankruptcy, the largest in American history. Other companies of comparable, even greater size, such as WorldCom, Tyco, Adelphia, Global Crossing, soon vanished for similar reasons. Part of Krugman's argument was that while the terrorist attacks had been an entirely unprecedented nature and scale, our entire system of financial regulation, accounting, business journalism was designed to prevent exactly those sort of frauds that brought down those huge companies. When a system fails so dramatically as its core mission, we must wonder which of our other assumptions are incorrect. So, I mean, basically, what are these corporations? Are they, they set up, this money laundering corporations? Are they social engineering schemes, vast wealth redistribution schemes? They're not really out there. They're not building a better mousetrap, providing a better service. They're just there to extort money or steal money and swindle, pull off big swindles, stock swindles and such. Which the banking system helps because they can always provide liquidity to the stock market. That's what quantitative easing was all about, goosing the market, as they say.
Yeah, and so we have a situation where the process by which large corporations come into our lives, what we see of it is propaganda. We're just given, like with Enron, this idea that it's just very good at debt manipulation and selling bonds, and it's very clever at the creation of credit and things like this. In back of it, it was all just hot air. It shows how easy it is to basically fool the public. Because one of the things we don't have, one of the things that the civics course needs to point out, is that there's no real accounting, right?
Mm-hmm.
What does a citizen know about why the government chose to give Tesla all this money? What do we know about where the money comes from to fund Walmart originally? What do we know about the decision by IBM to let the son of the president of Planned Parenthood have the operating system of the PC? What does a citizen know about this stuff? Nothing. Zero. We're in the dark.
Was there ever a public debate about the CIA performing a venture capital company called InQtel to finance the computer industry, telecommunications industry?
Where were those? You see, that's the thing. So because the citizen is impotent in so many ways, the facade really at this point is getting weaker and weaker. So. And just more and more absurd. So it should be easy for an aggressive, clear-minded civics course to penetrate these things and then to create new information and disseminate it. And so, one thing I did want to talk about was how would, the Tim and Joe civics course be organized, the one we're talking about? This is critical because I don't think you can look to professors. I don't think you can look to academics. This is unfortunately, it's just too debased and too controlled an area. You wouldn't want to select these people. So who could do it? I think that undergrads and perhaps people who are, in the first year of, history or political science master's programs.
Mm-hmm.
Someone like that wasn't completely you wouldn't have gone through the PhD system would be someone that you would look to start organizing this. I would say just automatically anyone who had gone all the way through and become a PhD should be shunned, because that's someone who has successfully demonstrated loyalty to the slave system, right? I mean, this would be what I would regard as the general, control that is exhibited by the student, to get something like as rarefied as a PhD. You've got to come all the way through the system. You've got to have dozens of people inspecting your work. And if there was any original thought that would be dangerous to the oligarchic control of the slave system, you would have been weeded out long ago, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just, that's unfortunate, but that's just the truth. Because there isn't any rebellion anywhere in the university system against the official government narrative of 911.
Yeah.
We can be 100% certain that there is a control that we don't recognize that's coming from above. And so what that means is that someone that can go all the way through the end and pop out the other side of the PhD is either, evil on the just in fact, or is someone whose mind has been so shaped and is so basically intellectually docile that they don't have any concern about him. He's been rubber stamped intellectually. He's just a tool. So how are you going to find someone to follow? Well, I think, you know, rebellious undergraduates and rebellious kids who are, you know, just starting master programs, they would have sort of an understanding of how academia operates. They could write a course outline, right? And then I think, okay, so that's how it should exist in the world of the university. Let's start seeing these kinds of ad hoc civics classes be developed. I think, you know, maybe the ones that we presented today are not perfect. Some of the ideas are not perfect. We can streamline it and perfect it, and there's many different opinions about it. But let's get started. Let's just like Uber is replacing, you know, a corrupt cab system that was inefficient. It's time for an Uber University, you know, which with a political science component that's the spearhead. The students should just organize it. And once you have a curriculum that's working, that's attracting other students, then this should be online everywhere. Every university should be challenged, you know, Notre Dame, you know, Columbia University, deep into the cesspool, you know, of the control. And there's got to be a few free thinking kids in these universities. Get started. Start producing, these alternative university systems, which are open-ended, which students can make discoveries, clarify the schematic. Tim and I talk about this, the schematic of the secret society and the oligarchic control. They can start plugging these things in and create curriculum, create courses, have a process where the freshman can come in, and when he pops out the other end as a senior, we can give him a little, the Tim Kelly Award for intellectual clarity. You know, there would be Tim could show up and we could create an outfit for him with like a pointy hat and stuff, and he could hand out like a piece of paper with a gold seal on it, and then there you go. And so this is what, and then, you know, like I can do Atwell. I mean, I'd be perfectly happy, Tim. I could just see us, you know, with in our regala splendor, with our robes and pointy hats, and with our little white paper with the shiny gold seal, you know,
playing pomp and circumstance. Huh?
Yeah, it'd be pomp and circumstance, and of course bagpipes, because I never appear in public without bagpipes. So, you know, so that you can see, there's a glorious future here, and this, you know, is a lot more fun than the insane indoctrination of the political science that you're going to get at the university. And so this will link into the natural kind of need for mischievousness and also for just, it'll have the ring of truth, you know? And so if you get it started, I think you're going to have, it'll be amazing how many people will rally to it. What do you think, Tim? You think, is the time right?
I think the time is long overdue. Whether it's right or not, I don't know. Because that, you're right. I mean, it is obvious. I mean, just the fact that supposedly the greatest constitutional republic in the history of the world has been stuck on two parties since the 1850s. That's kind of suspect, don't you think? A little bit of control going on there. It's either Coke or Pepsi. That's what
right.
The political of the Cola Wars. Yeah.
You know, I think just the simplest thing is just look. Just ask the dean why 911, be more specific. Just say, look, Building 7 collapsed symmetrically, free fall speed, pyroplastic cloud. These are all elements of controlled demolition. Nothing else can do it. And then the lady in the BBC is talking about the building collapse. So this is controlled demolition. Let's have a course on this.
Yeah.
See what happens. And then when you watch the ratcheting down, you can start kind of understanding how this control has, this black cloud of domination has completely taken over our American university system.
Mm-hmm.
It's everywhere. And then you can start plugging things into it. you can start plugging the Frankfurt School and, you know, polysexualism, you know, sexual degeneracy. And then you can start seeing, you know, well, here comes the people who are bringing out the GBTL course material.
And that's, you know, that's another thing you should bring up is the role of sexual degenerate behavior and blackmail and human compromise in the political process. That's just a huge control mechanism in the political process is blackmail and bribery, of course. And just, you know, a few case studies, if you just highlight, you have a case, there's a book called The Money and the Power about Las Vegas, a great book about the creation of Las Vegas and how the world of gambling and entertainment intersected. You know, the world of gambling, celebrity intersected with politics and politicians and these things. So, you know, you have Sinatra and the Kennedys and these. This is the late 50s and early 60s. But how many bodies are buried out in the desert around Las Vegas that got that city built? How much money was stolen from the Teamsters Fund and all illegality and corruption involved in that, and how that involved the corruption of the Mormon Church? Mormons were heavily invested in Las Vegas, these things. They used Catholic front men to do it. Also, you know, that also with Lansky and those characters, Mo Dalitz, who became a philanthropist because he made enough money to give it away. Same thing with Los Angeles and the water wars and Mulholland and these things. And this was all happening during the formation of Hollywood. So corruption is sort of burned into Hollywood's DNA. And the force of what Hollywood really represents there's always been a lot of talk of subversive elements trying to influence Hollywood. No, Hollywood is a subversive element.
Right.
Even Disneyland, like Disney, if you focus attention on the CIA's involvement in the building of Disney World in Florida, and what does that reveal? You get so many of these examples at some point, you have to draw some conclusions that these aren't separate accounts or cases. These things are all related, and after a while you'll see a pattern here, and this is how the entire system works. In fact, if you want to get a good analogy for what the United States represents, you can look at Las Vegas, sort of this amusement park built up top of a lot of dead bodies and corruption, and same with Disney World. There's a lot of corruption, politics, a lot of death, and also a good Masonic influence. So there you have America right there in a nutshell, right?
Yeah, that is our nation. Yeah. And a real civics class would bring this to light, wake people up and have a passing grade of rebellion. Mm-hmm. Because believe me, this isn't going to end well. This is going to end with, you talk about the Masonic control. Just remember, one of the courses should be entitled Political Control of the Masons, Master of Genocide.
Yeah. Right?
And just work through, you know, from Palmerston forward, the control of the Masons, and often in working in conjunction with elite Jewish families, of European genocide.
Yeah, and again, another course would be just the the importance of secret societies. In world affairs, there's World War One and or British Freemasonry in the British Empire. I mean, that's Jacobs has a book about British, the builders of empire, the role of Freemasonry in the empire, and the role that the lodges played in these things in purpose of networking, communication, and intelligence, and also as centers or agents of subversion, things like the French Revolution and everything. Spins out from there.
But it kind of shows when I think about. Like, you know, the examples you were giving and how clear the picture is, you know, of a country and the kind of response people would have. Like, you could really see that the civics courses we're replacing are also elements of control and ultimately of self-destruction, because in so many cases, the image of America that you presented so well at the beginning of the show is one of the things that leads for people to enter into the military, for example.
Yes. Yes.
You know, and so now you're buying into basically, you know, working for the government as a soldier. You're in the Middle East. You're slaughtering, you know, whoever they put in front of you.
You're getting 50 different vaccines at one time.
You're getting vaccinated to the point, you know, you're, you know, but so this is, this is a function of patriotism to some extent.
Yes.
And when that's shattered by an accurate civics course, then, you know, it's going to be harder for the government to get fodder for cannons. And this is useful. This is part of the rebellion that's the passing grade. You know, it's one of the things you have to do to get a passing grade is be alive. You know, if you're killed, that's kind of a failure.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we don't give posthumous Kelly academic awards. You know, you've got to be able to walk up and take the parchment with the gold seal on it. So stay alive, kids, and do this by, you know, learning your lessons,
mm-hmm.
Learning the lessons of what civics really are.
Yeah, I think what it is civic classes, political science, these instruct or pass down a sort of a canon of acceptable, polite thought. And
yep.
if you deviate from what's taught in these textbooks, you're outside polite society. You're outside the acceptable thought, and you become an outcast, and that's what the main function of these courses are.
To people. Yeah, well said. I mean that's they just add to the intimidation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, yeah.
They just add because, like, you know, anyone who's outside the box, you're in the civics course, and you've got you know a vicious you know lesbian. You know, PhD from Columbia University, that's browbeating anyone who, you know, is opposed to Frankfurt School, you know, cultural racism. It gets a little bit tough after 4 years to be able to, you know, at a party to really speak your mind clearly. So the one of the functions of the new civics courses is to, you know, basically, you know, create an environment where you don't end up intimidated. You don't end up afraid to speak your honest mind. You know, Tim, one thing that people can do who are actually in civics class is just to ask themselves this question. Is like, you know, my honest feelings, am I able, do I feel better about expressing them in public after the course, or am I more afraid?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that question might really clarify what the processes are going through and what they're actually learning or being conditioned by the course, you know, to become.
Yes. Yes. Okay. Well, Joe, I think we covered it.
Hey brother, I think we did. And, next week could be a bonus cause I might be back in the States, but I might be in, I don't know. I might be looking for a nation that would take me in. I hate to say it, but so far I put out an internet request and I've got zero responses, so I don't know where I'm going to be. I have no idea. I'm hoping to be back in the States, and if my home is available, then we will. If not, I will be checking in, but, you know, I can't even guess at this point where it might be from.
Okay, well, we'll keep in touch, and we'll talk next week. Until then, enjoy New Zealand.
Will do. Thank you. And enjoy, you know, the eastern seaboard. You're close to the belly of the beast, sir, so you can create more indigestion.
Yeah, I can see the eye of Sauron as I speak from my window. So.
Oh, well, incidentally, you know, I mean, that I just wanted, you brought that up. I mean, because I'm actually in the valley where they shot the Lord of the Ring films,
mm-hmm.
which is... basically, I forget, it's probably the Reese River Valley, I think we'd call it. It's the major river here. But I actually went yesterday to where they shot the Isengard, you know, the kind of the big castle area.
Mm-hmm.
And today I went to Middle Earth, you know, traveled around those areas. We aren't actually following the film. It's just these are places where there are hiking trails. And it's very beautiful. And I will say that the film was a complete fantasy. I haven't seen a Grok or a Hobbit, and all I see is the Masonic control, which is everywhere. I think I mentioned, you know, I stayed in Christchurch on our way down here, and we got a Airbnb. It was on Huxley Street. You you turned left on Disraeli Street and then right on Palmerston Avenue. And I'm not kidding. I mean, these are the names of the streets. It's all just, the whole thing is just this giant Masonic system down here.
That's fun. Yeah, it's fun.
Funny, yeah. All right, Brad. Well, talk to you soon. Be safe.
Okay, take care. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.